Good evening, everybody, and welcome to our regular Monday stream.
Oh,
I've got the day right this time.
You have indeed. Well done.
Yes, we have managed to announce the correct day. It's a low bar, but we try to meet it.
we nearly had Full Fact responding to us last week about the fact that we informed people that it was Wednesday, and this was misinformation because it was in fact not Wednesday.
It was not Wednesday, my dudes. It is in fact Monday, my dudes. So let's all have a good Monday. I hope you're all having a good day. The weather's been pretty good here.
It's been suspiciously windy.
It has been suspiciously windy. As we do our federally mandated preamble before we start the stream.
Yes. Proper.
Now we do tend to go over just a couple of details here. We've been getting a few questions about those still going to the informal Nomos event. I'm trying to make sure that the systems are correctly working. Eventbrite, you will get an email tomorrow. I apologize for the last minuteness of this, but I've been trying to make sure that people actually get the details and I'm not leaking details where they shouldn't be. So I'm trying to doubly make sure that the stuff we've got is correct because we're in kind of an odd situation with that. But thank you to everyone for bearing with us. I will send out a final warning for people who would like, refunds, because I've already started issuing a lot of them automatically. But it's a shame that we had to basically cancel part of that. But you guys have been pretty good with it, so we're kind of onwards and upwards, and it won't be our last Nomos event. But don't worry, guys, if you're still intending, if you've still got hotels booked, there will be details forthcoming. A couple of you have let you know already, but quite honestly, venues have been quite bad with communicating with us, and I didn't want to give people wrong information.
I think that's the thing that people don't maybe always realise, is that actually trying to organise these things in a transparent manner
and
not
difficult.
Put people in like unnecessary uncertainty is like actually very hard to do.
Yes.
And we would rather be very honest and just be like, look, you know, this is how it is until we can put it forward for definite about what's actually happening. So please be patient, and we will make sure that those who are interested, I mean, people could probably infer, I presume, anyway, because we said it would be in central Manchester nearby Oxford Road.
Yeah.
That the venues we might have picked for the same, or for this weekend around, might also possibly be in just in the same area.
Yes, yes. We're not putting people out. We're not moving it around. It'll still be very convenient for people to get to. But that's enough about our kind of in-person stuff. Do come see us if you're in Manchester next weekend.
Indeed.
But we have an interesting selection this evening of kind of facts all in one place. It's kind of a follow-up, really, to a stream. One of the first streams on this channel. One of the first episodes of back when you were Trig.
that would be too much deep lore for people if that was true.
No. That's
everyone's like, where's Trig? And it's actually just been me all along.
Yeah, it's just Evelyn. She does a funny voice. People do ask where Trig is. He's off in the real world, being happy in the real world. So
firing crossbows and
whatnot. Yeah, he's firing crossbows and being stuff like that. So the weavers in the chat, but it's something I've wanted to talk about for a little bit. Is this whole concept of the fact that the Great Reset for many people has already happened. But before we get too far into it, I have put it in the chat. If you guys want to donate to us without YouTube taking a cut, the best way to do that is through PayPal. You can support us on the Substack as well. I keep promising more stuff over there, but unfortunately it is yet to materialize, but we do have a decent back catalog of stuff on Substack you guys can read.
We are just very busy, I'm afraid.
Yeah, these two streams a week, as you'll see with the content of, of this stream, the next stream, and as you see the content of all our previous streams, they take a heavy amount of research. So they do take up most of our free time, really. So if you guys want to support us, you can donate over on the Anti-Politics Substack, because they take less money as well. Of course, we are fully monetized on YouTube, and
that's because, of course, we have an undying love for the nation of Israel.
Yes. people noticing the thumbnail, I'll address that in a minute, because it's an interesting story where that comes from. We'll also be using more of that person's art within the stream as well, so more of that to look at.
I'll say just one last thing, you know, as obviously there's those supporters, but just anyone that turns up for the streams or interacts with them or does the algorithm summoning comments and this, that, and the next thing, it's all appreciated.
Yes, thank you very much for your interaction with the video. Thank you for your donations. And like I said, we do have memberships as well if you guys want to support us on a recurring basis. Just, you know, be aware that any interaction through YouTube does have a 30% cut taken out of it. But it is also the most convenient way. So we've tried other formats, and quite honestly, I've been dissatisfied with some of the solutions. So we've got PayPal, we've got Substack, and we've got the YouTube for people and supporters. But anyway, that's enough preamble. Thank you, Melon, already for the $2 saying I love the nation of Israel. That does keep us safe. I'm sure we're doing some interesting line walking here.
But yeah, there's a sort of premise here that I think you could probably, I don't know, I mean, put the premise forward, and you can tell us via the, I was going to say aspects of like visual storytelling, possibly just through the thumbnail alone.
Yeah.
But you've still got a rough idea that we're going to look at the Great Reset as like 4 points.
Yeah.
And these aren't just points that we're just going to look at because, oh, that's the plan.
Yeah.
But these are the things that you would have to achieve if you wanted to reach the aims that are essentially put forward by like the World Economic Forum. Now, we know it's kind of like the boogeyman example for this, and there's a lot more clever stuff where you could go back to like old, you know, Council of Foreign Relations documents or RAND Institute stuff, which we've done before. So we know it's all out there. We've discussed the fact that they're up to this, and we want to put forward the point that really where we are now, you aren't going to combat the Great Reset, because if you are under the age of 30, not born into an affluent conservative family structure, or born into some sort of rural area where you've got land holdings or something like that.
Yeah.
The Great Reset's already happened for you. You are living amongst the demographic reorganization, if you framed it here, which would obviously be the prerequisite to destroying family structures.
Yes.
Heritage, wealth, all of that. Centrally planned cities, because you're of course going to be beholden to labouring in some sort of cosmopolitan hub, because you've been told that having a professional career where you've got almost no physical skills and all you do is plug data in a spreadsheet all day is the way to go.
Yeah.
Laterally, that then has a sort of effect of reduced population mobility. You become locked into what we now recognise as these 15-minute cities. Yeah. But ultimately, this is something that you can recognise in the form of London that's really existed since like the 90s. It's just the fact that the yuppies that were there making silly money back then made enough money and could buy enough things to satiate the complete erosion of culture. Or at least he thought so.
Well, the way we're going to look at this, I thought it would be useful to define the aspects of the Great Reset that are most visible. I think if you talk to most people who are clued up on, you know, the WEF agenda and all the stuff that's been conspiracy jacketed, they would pull out these 4 points. That, you know, you'll own nothing, you'll be happy, there'll be mass immigration, there'll be these centrally planned cities, and you won't be able to go anywhere in them. That is kind of the cereal box napkin scribble version of the Great Reset. And them coming forward and putting it in these conspiratorial terms is actually kind of genius.
Mm.
Because we'll be showing throughout this, these are things that have already happened. It was not a conspiracy to do these things because these things have already been done. And when you get people like, you know, David Icke and Gareth Icke and all of these websites coming out and conspiracy jacketing all of this, it really harms the point, and it makes people think that this is something that is in the future, and then in the far future in some cases, that it is a 9/11 style, ooh, JFK's brain, fun, true crime conspiracy. It makes it in people's minds almost like it's a fiction, when really what we'll be going through here is hard, cold reality. We get told that these streams are quote-unquote blackpilling, but usually what we do is use the regime's own sources where we think they are most likely to be telling the truth, because I think in this case they are quite likely to be telling the truth because they are motivated to hide much of this truth.
And we from our previous streams have enough reason to look through some of the statistics here and actually suggest that things may be worse than they are telling us, because we have very plain reason to suggest that they may be doing so.
Well, the illustrations you're seeing in the thumbnail there is by a woman named Laura Breeling, I think it's how it's pronounced. She's German, and her illustrations have appeared in The New Yorker, The Washington Post, The New York Post, I believe, or The New York Times, sorry. She has created campaign posters famously for the German Green Party, and the illustration you're seeing currently in the thumbnail is a picture that was created for Die Zeit newspaper. You can't even see all of the Globo slogans in the graffiti. There's an ACAB covered up by our text. There's a lot of stuff covered up and not as legible, but we'll be using some of these. Yeah, the Zero Whiteman, and that is a theme in most of her art, but she's somebody who gets used as, like, the ultimate Globo homo, almost like parody, like self-parody level.
Yeah, I know. I see some of the chats asking, what do we mean by possibly conspiracy jacked?
It's turning plain, boring fact into sensationalized stories that people are less likely to believe.
Yeah, like what you said about the JFK one, you got all this stuff about who was it, this group, was it that group, you know, so that you don't just recognize the fact that JFK was a shit lib communist and the CIA shooting them is probably the only good thing they ever did.
Ultimately, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter whether JFK was assassinated or not. And that's the position that we take.
But it becomes a larger part of the whole surrogate activity of, like, truth seeking. Oh, it's all about the truth and speaking truth to power. It's like, oh, no.
Oh no, for those asking, Ben Gale, no, this is not like a 4chan parody. This is not someone creating a dystopian image. This was in a German newspaper as an idyllic vision of a carless Berlin. That's where that image comes from. And that's why I want to use these, because they're so cartoonish in a way, but they're such a sneering victory lap in many ways, and they're quite visceral in communicating the point. But that's enough preamble.
We're running on limited energy today, so we'll try and get through these at a decent pace.
We shall try and get through these at pace. Yes, here we are at the first point, which is demographics, the demographic reorganization. We'll be focusing mostly on England and, you know, Britain as a whole, but there will be some wider kind of global and US stuff sprinkled in there to show you this is not isolated simply to the UK. It is a kind of a Western phenomenon in most of the quote-unquote developed nations, especially Germany, the UK, the US, Australia, New Zealand, Canada.
But also, like, we just live in Blighty, and this is God's country, so, don't know, suck it.
This is from, quite literally, gov.uk. These are the official government numbers about the population of England and Wales by ethnicity over time. And you can clearly see here that in 2001, sorry, the white British ethnic contingent of England and Wales
was nearly 90%.
Was 87.5%. And in 2021, it was 74.4%, which is a 13% drop.
Well, that's quite a considerable difference as well. That's,
yes,
that's 9 out of 10 to, you know, 75%.
It's 90% to 75%, effectively. It is a very large drop, especially with the population increases we have seen. The fact that there's been such a decrease in rural terms, there are a lot more and foreigners.
Like the rest of these statistics as well. This presumes that, one, they're testing against the correct number of total population,
yes,
which we know they aren't. And two, the thing I find so funny is, like, all of these things in, like, census statistics are predicated on the fact that, like, well, of course, immigrants are going to fill out the census,
yes,
in an honest and legitimate fashion. It's like, who are you trying to kid?
As we've talked about in previous streams, the idea that the numbers are reliable in terms of immigration. There's an article from The Spectator we talked about, which is one of the clearest acknowledged examples, because some of the other ones are contested very heavily, but about the fact that the amnesty for European immigrants who had no reason to fear their status was double the numbers that they presumed were in the UK. That's the kind of stuff we're dealing with in terms of unrecorded immigration here. So keep in mind, we are using census data, but it is very likely that this data is a lot more rosy than the real picture is. But this is the raw, kind of the raw immigration.
And this is, of course, a direct result of the market at work.
Yes.
It's just market forces.
Well, here we can drill into it again. how country of birth and passports held vary across England and Wales. This is a quick, just a quick example about London here. Again, this is from the Office for National Statistics. London has remained the region with both the largest population of people born outside the UK and the largest proportion of people with non-UK passports. In 2021, more than one in four, 40% of usual residents in London, that's recorded usual residents as well, were non-UK born. And more than one in five, 23.3%, have a non-UK passport. This is a small increase from 2011, where 36.7% of London residents were non-UK born and 21% had non-UK passports. 4% is quite a large gain. It's 10% of the number. It's generally doesn't include students.
That was a good point I've added on top here. And this is something actually Maven pointed out on Twitter the other day. I think we mentioned it before, but it's worth mentioning here.
Yeah.
That in our immigration statistics, we don't count students.
No.
Because in theory, they go back. Now, that's all very well and good if there's like, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 a year come and go. But when you're talking probably a block of people that are not far off their millions, I would presume across all the universities, all the colleges in the UK, you know, we need to be able to make up for that and, you know, adjust whatever social services or this, that and the next thing for that extra million people. Say.
Yes.
But they are constantly replenished and topped up by ever more foreign students coming in and replacing the ones that are leaving. And then you have this sort of entire demographic that then just becomes completely unaccounted for in any of these statistics.
Yes, the student population who is considered basically non-UK residents, they're considered students, obviously. Mm. That's why the settled numbers of 700,000, possibly for 2022, as we talked about, don't gel with the 1.4 million visas that were issued in 2022.
And the thing with the students as well is we know that they are a highly dependent group.
Yes.
You know, the whole idea of being a student and being in training economically is it costs, you know, us some amount per year for the next 4 years to educate you, and then over the next 10 years of your working life after those 4 years of education, you'll make 4 or 5 times that back and benefit society on a wider front. However, if you only subsidise foreign people's education that they then go make a profit with outside of the UK, you know, it's like a lose. It's just so many compounding effects.
Well, what I want to point out here is that in contrast, both Wales and North East England had approximately 1 in 14 usual residents born outside the UK. Similarly, Wales and the North East also had the lowest proportions of population with non-UK passports. What this is telling us that this is an urban phenomenon. We know about Birmingham, we know about Manchester, we know that the urban centres of Britain are largely populated by non-white people, and they are largely populated by foreign-born people now. We've reached the point where we're counting, you know, 40% of London is a first-generation immigrant, which is an insane figure, but that is the concentration you get within urban areas. And that becomes important when you look at the rest of the kind of picture, because all of these factors compound together for how people under the age of 30 in Britain experience their reality in Britain.
Well, also just what the people under the age of 30 in Britain are now.
Yeah.
To some great extent.
Well, we'll get to that, but this is extremely concentrated in urban areas. But it gets worse. The age and ethnicity figures directly from the ONS are hidden, effectively. They put the cart before the horse. They give you figures that are percentage of mixed race people who are 0 to 4, rather than percentage of 0 to 4 people who are mixed race, if you know what I mean.
Yes.
So 15% of 0 to 4s in the UK aren't mixed race. It's that mixed race people in the UK, 15% of them are age 0 to 4. So they don't really show the proper figures here. But this should really show you about how skewed young, if you look at the 25 to 29 area, there's a bit of a divide here, but if we go to the, it's really difficult to see, they made it very hard to see, the white figure here is level in areas, and then it kind of drops off, percentage-wise. So there's a relatively even distribution within kind of 18 to 24 afterwards, but before that, under 18s, there's a large dearth of white, and that is not white British, that is simply just white.
Mm. And that's why we get, like, they're sort of obvious now, I suppose, like those pictures of, like, this ex-primary school in the south of London or ex-primary school in Bradford, and there is not a white face amongst them.
No. It is very hard to get a proper demographics picture for that. But luckily, Migration Watch and also some of the local councils as well have recorded this in a bit more detail. These numbers are from 2015, but this is just from Sandwell in London. This is the ethnic story of a single district. And it is one in London that is not particularly considered ethnically diverse. If you look at some of the numbers here, they show that white British households are far larger in terms of certain demographics than they are in other neighbourhoods. You'll see here that St. Paul's, Soho, and all of that have much larger immigrant populations. This is actually a relatively white part of London, or at least it was in 2011. But this picture is indicative of basically all, even considered white enclaves of urban areas. You see here that the 80s and over represent a earlier picture of Britain.
Yes.
And anyone who is basically 40 and over, you see the big jump there, has a very false picture of how Britain looks. They live effectively in an alternate reality. You see here that the bulk of immigrants really exist in this 30, you know, kind of below 39, but really kind of below the 5 to 9 and 0 to 4 in this area, really. You see a hard divide there that you have hovering around about 50% of the population being white in these age groups, and then eroding steadily as you go from under 19s to effectively infants. And that is a familiar picture, if you drill into the data, throughout the UK, that you have this balance here where the white population, in quotes, is the top-heavy old people we're warned about. And when the boomers die off, it's going to become the situation where only 60% of Britain is white British at most.
And as we'll get further on here, just look at that graph and imagine, because of course there would have to be the sort of, I don't know if stratification would be the right word, but the sort of dispersal of family connections that are broken.
Yes.
Throughout that sort of period of time, you know, those who are the 80 and over group, what percentage of, say, you know, the 20 to, let's say, the 0-4 right up to like 19 or whatever.
Yeah.
Is there actually a connection across that at all? Or are we just seeing, you know, essentially old white people in their 70s and 80s who have almost no heritage that they've passed on, and consequently young people being born who have no, you know, native grandparents or even maybe parents in some sense to actually look to?
Well, this is a great indication. The non-native population of Britain skews heavily young.
Mm.
And you're right in that because of increasing urbanisation and other factors, that young people in Britain are separated from their families. And described it as a racial jungle? Was that Biden? Was that they are being thrown into Biden's racial jungle here? But this, I thought, was a good visual representation, because data like this is hard to find, because data like this is alarming, and that's why the ONS breaks it up differently. It gets even more alarming when we take the ONS's own figures about births. These are the main points about births in England. These are live births in England as counted. So there'll be a lot of births that aren't counted or miscounted. Or again, you can't deal with the grey and unseen population sentence in Britain. But these are the government's own numbers when it comes to live births in the UK. They try and make them look more rosy than they actually are. We'll get onto the real picture from Migration Watch later. But in 2021... 28.8% of live births were to non-UK-born women, so first-generation immigrants.
Mm-hmm.
This is a decrease from 29.3% in 2020. The total fertility rate increased for UK-born women to 1.54, mostly due to second-generation immigrants.
Yes.
The fertility rate for non-UK-born women remained at 2.03. So basically, what you're getting is a 25% higher fertility rate for non-UK-born women in the abstract, and not accounting for, quote-unquote, non-white British births, which is a large percentage of births that are counted as non-first-generation immigrants. So you can see here that the picture, even this is not London. This is UK-wide. So the picture in the entirety of, I believe this is England and Wales. Sorry, this is not UK-wide. This is England and Wales, because they like dividing them up like that. But the picture in England and Wales is that roughly 30% of all live births are to mothers who were not born in the UK. And that's not counting mothers who were born in the UK and fathers who weren't.
Well, see, I would also think as well that I actually think that non-UK born women remained at 2.3. That actually seems quite low. But I suppose if you were to factor in, you know, old Caribbean families, old Indian families, and a lot of older Chinese families who have no children.
Yeah.
Because they basically come over here as like cosmopolitan rejects from their own cultures, you know, 20, 30 years ago, that you would find, you know, the new families of Pakistanis, Assyrians, Eritreans, you know, whoever's coming across now, the last 10, 15 years, that their rate won't be like 2, it might be like 2.5 or 3.
Well, here's Migration Watch doing the heavy lifting for us, really. And here's their numbers on population increase due to births. And they show that non-UK born outnumber UK born in terms of population increase.
Someone put a very good point in their chat. Births per woman is only half the picture. Need to understand the generational length as well.
Yes.
Which, of course, for those people who are going to be having more kids, is going to be shorter, which gets a compounding effect again. Meanwhile, now, what is it? On average, I think we've got other statistics for it later, but births are coming later and later and later amongst the native population.
Yes, which causes issues and means that they will have smaller families. That is something I didn't want to tackle. That's its own rabbit hole. We'll probably get into that when we tackle immigration itself. But here are the raw numbers from Migration Watch. Between 2014 and 2019, the white British birth declined from 65% of total to 61% as a share of live births, which ethnicity was stated in England and Wales. So there's a degree of uncertainty there, but that's the best we can do. In contrast, while the total number of births to all other ethnicities is smaller, the share of births to all other ethnicities increased from 34% to 39%. So not counting direct immigration, the birth impact in terms of non-white British is 40% in the, you know, the generations of the last 5 years. So the generation of the last 5 years, without the input of immigration, they are 40% non-white British, which is massive. And this is why I keep saying to people that the Great Reset has already happened in terms of demographics. This is the best evidence of it. You're told that, you know, 25% of Britain is non-white, but effectively 40% of Britain in terms of its future is non-white British.
And that's only ever going to get worse.
Yeah, that's only ever going to get worse. That is a trend that is accelerating. And that's if we shut the border now.
Yes.
That's if there is zero immigration and emigration of native British people from now. That is the situation that we find ourselves in. And it's one that I think a lot of the rhetoric against the Great Reset is delusional in that fact. Because
yes,
it does not understand the current demography. The demography itself is put forward in the headlines alarmingly when it comes to 25%, but the 40% of live births in Britain being to non-white British mothers would alarm a great number of British people.
Yeah, I think if it was put in those very clear terms to people, that in anywhere that isn't really rural Northern England or Scotland or bits of Wales, that essentially one of every two births is from non-white couple, you know, is of mixed heritage or is Pakistani, you know, non-UK heritage as a whole sort of category of its own represents all of that.
Well, let's move on quickly. We can talk about some of the US picture here as well. I think I might have actually missed something in the Migration Watch. I apologize. Because they have a thing about ethnic minority school children as well, which I think is a very, very good point.
Yeah.
Where's the school section? Sorry, I missed it. Here, there it is. This is the kind of rising rate of ethnic minority pupils in state-funded education. And their summary here is that the ethnic minority component of the of ages 5 to 16 school population in England has increased from 16.8% in 2003 to 33% in 2020, which is huge.
Yes.
That is a 17-year doubling of the proportion of ethnic minority children in British schools, in British primary schools. In 2020, there were 8.1 million pupils in England state-funded primary schools and secondary schools. In primary schools, 33.9% of these were of ethnic minority background. So 34%, so even more. And 32% in secondary schools. So it's higher than that 30%. I think they might also be talking about like sixth forms and things like that. But the percentage in the census is 34% of primary school children are non-British.
I find it interesting in this graph here that they have, the, or at least they're projecting that the secondary school amount will overtake the primary school amount. So are they in here already suggesting that in 10 or 15 years' time, that some sort of weirdness is going to cause age-based demographic decline even within the immigrant populations?
That's been long predicted. That's something we're going to have a stream about at some point, which is the fact that nobody's talking about all the research pointing to massive demographic collapse globally, that we will possibly go back down to like 5 billion people within 50 years.
God, we can only hope.
Well, it's on with the demographics in China, it's almost certain. But this is the scale of the problem here. And then we'll do a sum up at the end. But yes, 34% of primary school children in Britain are not ethnically British. That is by the ONS's own numbers. That is the stated number that I believe is the floor rather than the ceiling. But we shall move on. The US has long been demographically destroyed in terms of its future generations. I'm sorry. In 2012, the non-white births were outnumbered by the white births were outnumbered by non-white births for the first time. That was 11 years ago. demographically, the Great Reset happened in America over a decade ago.
Yes,
and this would involve like mass deportations of settled peoples to reverse. That is the scale of the problem in the U.S. And as we move forward, this is from 2020. Basically 9 years after that was published, children of color already make up a majority of kids in many US states. And there's the point here that really, by the middle of this...
God, yeah, that graph there, that's quite damning, that.
Here's the US Y population over time. Stays very steady until, well, the 1960s, would you look at that? And then it just goes from 84% all the way down to 60%. But in most states in America... most children of school age are non-white.
And then you've got the wider problem of miscegenation in America, which is its own whole issue on top of that. And the fact that probably some 10 to 15% of people within the white group probably wouldn't really count as white to folk like ourselves.
It's a whole quagmire, because in multicultural society, deliberately, there is a blurring of heritages, and it is used as a way to deracinate people. We talked about it during our sensible discussion on race, and we talked about it a little bit during our Who is the English stream. Go back and watch those if you want to see more of our opinions on not only demographics, but also like racial metaphysics. They're kind of interesting, and a lot of people weren't expecting that. So,
and shall we say that there is obviously the racial demographic aspect. We can now go on to look at what we could refer to as maybe the age.
Well, here we go.
Here's working parts of this as
it's,
well.
It's a little bit here. It's incremental, but race of U.S. children by age. Non-whites outnumber whites in all children under the age of 10. So the demographic collapse in terms of the magical 50% has already happened within the U.S. The demography is destiny. People will be very very annoyed by this, but it's true. And currently there is nothing being done about this. In fact, it's being accelerated the direction. Again, this is why we say demography-wise that the Great Reset has already happened. But the next pillar to all of this It's not merely demographics. It is where these people are. It is housing and living. As we talked about previously, London and other urban centres are already majority non-white, and in some areas are nearly majority non-British born. That doesn't mean very much, but it's a great indicator about how far things have gone. But the other pillar to the Great Reset is where people are living and how they are living, not just who. We've gone through the who is living.
How are they living?
And now we're going to the how are they living, which is
where are they living?
Yeah, how and where are they living, which really, the plans of the managerialists, the global managerialists, are very clever in that they tackle the who, the what, the where, and in some cases even they give a why.
Yeah, but I think as well we could also look at this as a complete extension of the revolution of mass and scale.
Yeah.
And as we've covered both in democratization and in bits of writing here and everywhere, that this is a necessary consequence of the industrial revolution that we have been living through for the last 200 years, if not longer. The dissolution of community, the dissolution of culture tied to lands and a fashion that is immobile, that is stationary, that is permanent. These things are all things that we have lost now because we all have become cosmopolitan, we're metropolitan, we move from all these different places to one and the same, yet they all look the same, and so on and so forth.
Jack Fitzgibbons, you must be new here. Do go to our Substack if you want to see our opinions on constructive solutions, because we quite literally give speeches in person to rooms full of 70, 80 people about the constructive solutions.
Either the viability of them or at least being realistic about them.
I don't want to keep repeating myself, but we'll do a roundup at some point of, you know, our speeches, what we believe, things like that. But that is tackled a lot in our in-person meetings.
Yes.
We are very, very forward about what we believe solutions are. And we have quite rigorous and grassroots and I think achievable ideas when it comes to what those are. So do go over to the Substack and do read those if you want to see what our actual solutions are to all of this. Because some people aren't happy with them, but they're at least, you know, not pie in the sky a lot of the time. But anyway, I understand it's a sincere question, but we're just trying to show definitively to kind of move past the whole point of, you know, there's a lot of energy spent stopping the Great Reset. And this really is about putting all that information in one place, letting you see how it all compounds together. Because I see almost none of this talked about in a totalistic manner. But anyway, young people leading 21st century resurgence in city centre living. The report, Urban Demographics, Where People Live and Work, shows that the population of large city centres in England and Wales has more than doubled between 2000 and 2011. This is in 2015, by the way, with the number of residents aged 20 to 29 nearly tripling. This group now makes up almost half, 49%, of total populations of large cities. One of the big factors attracting young people to city centres is proximity and availability of jobs, with three times as many city centre residents walking to work than those living in suburbs or rural hinterlands. They talk about the hinterlands here and the fact that basically there is a mass demographic divide in England between the countryside, the suburbs, where you have a lot of under-18s and children, and the cities. Basically everybody who is 20 to 30 years old in Britain lives in a city
or lives in some form of cityified town or village that is a part of a rail link to a city and has thereby become a sort of extension of that, which is why you can have these weird councils in the south of England that don't have what you think would be the population density or resources to put forward elements of very intense leftist or environmental activism.
Yes.
But because the populace that lives there just becomes a concentrated sort of client group for a city like London, you actually have an accelerated effect there than you even would in a city because it's happening against such a low background level of other things.
Well, it also points out that London has also seen slower growth in its citizen population in many places. So this urbanisation is not just a London phenomenon. Mm. It's happening Manchester, Birmingham, all the larger cities in England and in Scotland as well, really, are sucking all the young people out of the quote-unquote hinterlands.
Every time we go into Manchester, I am always horrified by the sight of the number of large tower block buildings being put up specifically to house both students and quote unquote young professionals, to the extent that these things seem to go up basically every other week.
Yes, they do. I'm involved in some of it, and there is a mass scramble to build these ridiculous pods. These are the pods.
Mm.
These people, as we'll see, go into city centres and they live in the pod. They are already in the pod. The Great Reset has already happened for them in terms of housing. It talks about, you know, the rise for demand in assisted living has put serious stress and pressure on housing in many places. With the share of households in large cities classed as overcrowded, having increased by 69%. Again, this is by design. This is population density and population control 101.
The bottom sort of bullet point there. People move away from city centres as they get married, start families, or get older. But young people aren't doing that.
Yes.
They aren't getting married. They aren't starting families. And when they do get older, most of them get old in a way that makes them sort of decrepit and, I don't know, essentially useless. Because, I mean, there's a whole wider point here of, you know, what has the modern diet done to people? What does modern living in cities actually do to your physical capabilities?
Dutton complaining about you streaming the same time as him. It's nice that he sees we're streaming, but if he wants to set up some kind of schedule where we have handovers, I'd be very willing to.
We were here first.
Yeah, to be fair, this is our regular Wednesday.
It's also, I believe he's doing a stream on buggery, so who else would he be talking about?
Yeah, I'm good. Oh, that's kind of funny.
We love you, Edward.
We do. He's one of the good ones. But in terms of demographics, you see that young people are herded into cities. That is an obvious point. And I'm not going to go through it here, but I put the report in the notes. We'll have notes in the pinned comment, as they always do. I put the report in the notes for completeness for you to do your own research and look at the granular numbers. But really, the whole takeaway is that working age people in England, especially younger working age people, are disproportionately located in cities, even more so than they were in the 90s. So that's the takeaway here. The next part of this puzzle is, well, the factors that drive people out of the cities, out of the pods, are diminishing.
Yes.
This is from January 2022, The Guardian. Record numbers of women reach 30 child-free in England and Wales. And as we've talked about, this is mostly native British women. This is mostly white British women who reach 30 childless, overwhelmingly.
Of course, the picture they choose to use for this article
is a black family, yes. But they've got kids. That's weirdly like a sideways red pill, but we'll move past that. In 1971, just 18% of 30-year-olds had no children. Today, the figure has risen to 50%, reports the Office for National Statistics. Again, 1971 isn't a world away. This is post, you know, 60s, post women's lib, in quotes. It's post kind of the UK version of civil rights.
I was going to say, I think we can do, through all of the results that we have in front of us here, and some of the more of the ones we're going to pick out, a perfect demonstration of what AA has been talking about for years and what we have also sort of talked about in similar manners, that you change the laws, you change the legality around behaviour, and then the behaviour begins to take its own form, and then that reinforms the culture itself. So of course, you know, in the 70s and 80s, there's a push for the original women's liberation, there's a push for immigration, and then here we are, 50 years later, no one who's born as a white woman can be arsed having kids anymore.
It's not that they...
Our country's flooded full of brown people. Now everyone wants to live in a city and eat bugs.
Well, they don't... As we'll get onto, they don't want to. This is largely a result of economic reality.
Mm.
They do not want to live in the pod. They don't want to eat the bugs, really. Well, it doesn't matter if they do or they don't, is the point. That they will eat the bugs and they will live in the pod because they are incentivized to.
Yeah. I mean, there is obviously the point that it's just more difficult to have kids today than it was before.
It's
more expensive. And the likelihood that you are an individual who happens to be essentially infertile is a lot higher these days for a whole host of reasons.
Well, as we're going on to, the living situation of these young people is mostly shared accommodation. How are you going to raise a family when you're in one of these homes of multiple occupants, as you're getting to? When you live in your 30s, in a single room on a decent wage.
Basically, like student accommodation.
Yeah, people are living in effectively permanent student accommodation to get to these, you know, these places where the jobs are in these urban centres. And that really is why people aren't having babies. It's not a what we would think of as an emergent choice.
Yeah. So there's just to make sure we're keeping ourselves in check here, there's no family structure that exists beyond one or two generations because everybody is either demographically split across different races or is essentially gentrifying themselves in modern cities and therefore being in a situation where they cannot have children for one reason or another, or they choose not to. And then this is all compounded across the fact that, well, then there becomes no way to hand wealth across generations. And even the wealth that does get handed across generations gets spent on rent.
Yes, well, here's something from the ABC Finance Limited, who have collected some stuff in a weirdly weirdly reactionary stuff here from somewhere who's just trying to kind of collect stuff and show that people are renting. But it's called The Truth Behind Generation Rent. Recent figures suggest that up to a third of millennials may never be able to own their own home in their lifetimes. They have no option but for renting their entire lives. While half will rent well into their 40s. And really, they're just sharing what AA showed.
Oh, God, yeah, the numbers at the far right of the graph here are just unbelievable.
Well, this is from 1996. The numbers here, it says, why is it so difficult to get onto the property ladder? And it's just a comparison of average property price to average salary. It doesn't go into labor hours and things like that, which makes the picture
even worse.
It actually makes it double in some cases. But in 1996, the property value, average property value to average salary ratio was 3.55%.
You could basically look at that as you would have to earn 3.55 years worth of the average salary, not spend a penny, and in theory, you could afford a house.
And in 2021, this is prior to the 2022 continued rise in property prices, the average ratio is 10.92.
Now, like, to try and put that into some sort of thing that, because I suppose some people don't do the back of the bag paper math for this sometimes, and that you would have to, you know, you go to school, you do your 13 years of education full time, you go to university, you do your 4 years to get your degree, maybe you do another one on top for a master's.
Yeah.
You're already, you know, 21, 22. You've then got to go do an internship for a couple of years until maybe you're 25, 26.
Yeah.
Maybe at that point you get in a job that pays something close to 40 grand a year. You then spend the next 5 or 6 years getting yourself on steady financial feet and paying off bits of your student mortgage. And then you're sitting there in your 30s still paying rent, probably still looking at another decade before you could actually save up to put down a decent deposit on a house.
It's the simple fact that women are not having children, especially British women who live inside the system, are not having children because they do not live in family homes and cannot afford to live in family homes.
Well, yeah, it's obviously there is an aspect to this that immigration and mass immigration to the scale obviously puts extra stress on the demand for housing. But consequently, as you're suggesting there, if people aren't cohabiting in the same levels, if they aren't, you know, I think about maybe the way my mum and dad did, where, okay, they still lived in a somewhat city region, but they lived in a flat together and had me. There's not even that happening anymore. So, you know, let's put them 10, 15 years ahead, saying they're trying to sort their lives out now. What's the likelihood they actually cohabit and have a child together?
Yes,
maybe they don't. Maybe they live separately, and in doing so, take up two properties.
Yeah, that's a huge part of it, is the incentivization of single-parent households as well has caused great pressure on the housing market. But the fact remains that in terms of income ratio, houses are more than three times more expensive compared to people's incomes than they were in 1996, which is just the raw factor of the fact that these people never live in their own homes. UK homeownership rates by age 30, baby boomers 50%, Gen X around about 45%, and millennials around about 30%, maybe just under. Here it talks about percentages of private single renters and shared properties, renting with others, renting alone. This is the big number here.
Yeah.
This is why people aren't having children, because 43% of 25-year-olds live in shared accommodation. Even those at 35, 34 to 35-year-olds, it's 26%. And this is only going to get worse as time goes on. This is the generation we have now, rather than the generations of the future. So if you look at the 20 to 21, it might not be 64% by the time they're 30, but it'll probably be close to 50%.
And you'll find that the 20 to 21-year-olds 10 yeah. years from now might be looking at 70 or 80%.
Or maybe even 90% of these people living in single rooms.
Yep.
These are people who live in single rooms. So 50% of people who are, you know, 22 to 23 live in a single room, which is a staggering number. And a lot of the other people live in small flats.
Yeah. Well, that one you've got down there, that's basically an explanation of what we were talking about earlier, though, that the average number of working years it would take to save up for what they got, standard two-bed property based on 20% saving per month of average UK millennial wage, which is not achievable for most people. Being able to put one-fifth of your wage away is actually a great privilege.
I got great at London, 15 years. But that's, I don't want to go into too much detail, but that's the reality of the living situation. They don't have kids, they live in cities, and they live in cities in pods around brown people. That's what I'm trying to get you here. The situation described in the literature of the Great Reset is the reality for people under 30. That is what's going on here. And we're going to keep hammering you with it because it keeps getting worse. Why are more young people living with their parents? This is from February 2016. But you, again, even from 1996, again, the percentage of people, or the number of people living with parents, one in four young adults were living at home in 2015. So it's not just they're living in the pod, they're also just living in their bedrooms.
No, this is something I recognise. That for me to have left the home, God, nearly 6 years ago now at age 17, and to have done so permanently, is actually like quite a strong rarity.
It is extremely unusual. It's not something I was able to do. I moved in and out a little bit until my kind of mid-20s, really, when I was able to buy this property. Well, I rented a property previously, but I was able to buy this property. But it is unusual. My case unusual, your case unusual. So we have a much more independent living situation, a much more independent history than most of our respective generations do. One of the bigger things that I found while researching this is that it says 25% of generation rent, which basically means people who are under the age of 30, millennials and Gen Zs who are over the age of 18. 25% of them have moved 10 or more times since they left the family house, which is about twice as many moves as their parents did in their entire lives.
Yep.
The average Gen Xer, I believe, moves 5 times. The average boomer, about 4 to 5. And the average above that, it gets lower and lower. But these aren't just people who are living in the pod. They are also rootless.
Mm.
They are a rootless bunch of people who 25% of them have had to move 10 times.
Well, see, we know as well that it's not even the case that, like, oh, they aren't going to church or they aren't part of some local tradition or heritage. They don't even have neighbours that they can speak to. It's like that level of deracination.
These people are from nowhere. They feel they belong nowhere. And this is why. These are the raw facts behind it. They cannot afford to buy their own homes and they have to move sometimes every year. I've experienced it myself, having to move around for work in terms of renting accommodation that isn't my own home. I've decided not to play that game anymore. It is not worth doing. But that is the reality for many young people, that a quarter of them just have to keep moving almost on a yearly basis, which is a sorry indictment, really, of the current state of things, and one that should show you that why these people are so rootless and so hopeless and so easy to control.
Yes.
Again, this is Great Reset, people moving between pod stuff. It is nightmarish, but this is the reality for under 30s in Britain. Where are these people living then? These people are living in what are called homes of multiple occupation, or HMOs, or HOMOs.
Yes. Basically, take like a big, what would have been a big 3 or 4 bedroom house that would have been owned and taken care of by an entire family, extended relatives, and a whole host of children with possibly like a decent plot of land on it. And you turn the land into a car park, put slage style locks on like every single one of the bedroom doors, and then pretend that it's like a 4 or 5 bedroom, like, you know, student apartment
Yes.
or young professional condominium. And what that essentially means is the property gets treated like dirt and it gets filled with people who don't actually engage with one another. They just
No.
become 4 or 5 people who all live in a space.
It says, against a gloomy outlook, how will residential investment property fare? The stuff about homes of multiple occupants in the UK is not collected by the ONS. They deliberately turned a blind eye to this. Most of this is basically property heads drooling about the return on investment and the lax rules now surrounding HMOs. The increase of the provision of homes of multiple occupancy, HMOs, over the last 10 years has seen the trend for single adults and couples to remain in shared accommodation longer. Large portfolio landlords saw a healthy growth in value over 2021, but the value of one bedroom accommodation has decreased. So what it shows is that people, it's a council tax dodge. I've done it myself. If you live in a one bedroom flat, it is not very much different than living in one of these homes of multiple occupancy, except you get charged council tax.
Yes. So
So,
there's no reason to live in a
no.
property that you have complete ownership over. I mean,
Yeah.
that's kind of the way that we really should be looking at this here, is that not only do these people in these HMOs, not get along, they don't really have a proper social setting, they're using a house that really should be used for a family. They are also just like, I've somewhat lost my train of thought there. No, I forgot where I was gonna
Well,
go.
they're slums is
Yes.
the issue. That these homes of multiple occupancy are a sign that people can no longer afford to live in studio apartments.
Yes.
If you are under the age of 25, you are very likely, if you live away from your parents, to live in one of these homes of multiple occupancy.
But sorry, yeah, that's what I can say. They don't even live in a single property that they at least rent exclusively for themselves. There is
Yes.
no sense of ownership even over your kitchen, because that's now it's a shared space, it's communal living.
Well, like I said, the big thing is that these are slums. They're just dressed up slums. Thank you for the donation, AC, £10. I'll just call you AC. Bit of support, no need to read off. Thank you for the stream, but I've read it off anyway. I don't want to dox you. Thank you, AC. You know who you are. Thank you for the £10 there. But the point is that the housing situation is so grim for the under 25s that they live as immigrants did, you know, as the poor immigrants are shown as living in the 1960s. It was shown as them living in these horrible slum conditions, you know, 5 or 6 to a house, living in single rooms. That's just how young people live in Britain now. They are just a lot of people as well who are on good wages in the southwest of England will live in these situations, as they said here, well into their 30s, a lot longer. You can be somebody who is on 30k plus who lives in the southwest of England. And you will rent a single room and not be able to save right up until your mid-30s, really.
And why is it that people are doing that? Because mobility is so restricted in regards to getting to and from just like a job.
Yes, the next part of this puzzle, in terms of the increased urbanisation, the demographic collapse, is the fact that these people cannot leave where they are.
Yes.
And if they do leave where they are, they have to move city. They have to go from city to city. From urban, you know, hellhole to urban hellhole, they are not able to move out to the suburbs or towns where property prices are cheaper because they cannot find work, because they cannot drive or afford to drive. Here's just from the RAC. Again, the decreased mobility, I think, is something we've talked about. It's one of the quiet cornerstones of the Great Reset, is
Yes.
demobilisation. Go back and watch our demobilisation stream if you want to get a fuller picture of that. But from the RAC, young drivers who recently passed their tests set to be banned from giving friends lifts. So
But
even
what about the environment, Mr. RAC?
it's just well, that's the government talking. It's not Mr. RAC, but it's yeah. It's that there's this ridiculous cartoonish. Again, if you are a young driver, you have a black box. I don't
Yeah.
have that on here, but basically, if you are under the age of 25 and
And you want to insure, well,
you want insurance, period.
you
You have
legally
to.
can't get it without basically a tracker nowadays, which in and of itself is ridiculous, because what's like an average insurance plan on a cheap like 1 liter motor
We'll get into
nowadays?
that.
I was going, well, because we're getting close, we're already 8 o'clock here and we've got
Yeah,
quite a
no.
bit to go. I'd rather not be here till 9.
Here's the car insurance for 18-year-olds, and these are the cheapest ones. If I go by average price, the cheapest car to insure is a 1.25 door old Volkswagen Polo.
And I presume that price as well is, of course, if you park on your mum and dad's driveway in the Cotswolds.
These are more realistic. Peugeot 108, 1.2 Pure. Again, these are city cars. These are Peugeot 108s. These are Seat Ibizas, Toyota Igos. These aren't big fancy cars.
What if you live in Manchester or Glasgow or London or Edinburgh and you're street parking?
Yeah.
I mean, forget it. You've $4,000 or $5,000 a year insurance.
Well, that's the point, in that they kind of go into here that the fact that they're, if you live in places where it's cheap, you know, cheap is Truro. London is $2,223 for like a basic car. You aren't getting car insurance in London if you are 18 years old.
I bet you London E10 is probably a very specifically chosen one as well.
Yeah. If you live in London, you can't get car insurance if you're 18 for under $2,000. Good luck getting finance for that too.
And this completely reorientates how late millennials, Zoomers, can actually engage with the world around them. And I'm going to say maybe move on to the next one here.
Yeah, used car prices soared at a record high. The typical second-hand motor is now £4,000 priced than a year ago, with big family models in demand.
The idea of like the banger in the 80s or 90s, that you could take £300-400, go to a local second-hand car auction, buy something with 6 months MOT, learn how to actually fix and manage the vehicle yourself.
Yeah.
Which, like, I think about how my parents sort of came into the world in like the late 80s, early 90s. They all had cars. They all drove around because it cost, you know, like less than a quid for a gallon of fuel. And they knew how to fix them. They knew how to manage them and take care of them and appreciate them as machines. Nowadays, that if you're lucky enough to get a motor, you're probably just some snobby arsehole who gets mum and dad's old car that's some new model 2014, 2015 thing that's a closed-off electric box that you can't fix.
Thank you for the donation there, Sam153, $11. Thus as Britain as the rest of the Anglosphere it seems, thanks for the stream, and thank you for the €2 or €2 there, Mosey, basically just saying the West has fallen. But you're right in that these are average prices. This isn't, if you use your car for business, because when I have a car, I put business use on it because I have to, that goes up dramatically. It can as much as double. If you're somebody who is like 19 and you want to be like a self-employed plumber, or you know, you're 21 and you want to be a self-employed plumber, and you get yourself a van, you try and insure yourself a van for business use, they're going to charge you like $10,000.
Well, and that would be why there are basically no young people that drive anymore.
Now, number of young drivers plunges to record low.
It's funny, isn't it? We have a change in roadworthiness standards. We have the scrappage schemes built on top of eco-legislation, built on top of this, that, and the next safety standard. All of a sudden, young people just don't drive anymore.
Yes.
Who'd have thunk it?
It's less a nudge, more of a kick.
Yes.
We talk a little bit, I think there's a little bit of sauce here, but basically just, it's a record low. There's a record low in raw terms, not just even percentages, but in raw terms.
Yep.
A record low of young drivers on the road. If you are under 30, it is quite likely that you don't drive. If you're under 25, it is very, very likely, if you're between 18 and 25, that you do not drive. It is quite simply unaffordable for working class people to drive in Britain, because a used car that is half the average price is £9,000. And insurance on a small city car is £2,000.
Well, I was being generous as well with the HMO situation by suggesting that it might have a car park. Most of them do not.
No, most of them do not have a car.
Now, if you live in the city centre of London, you've got to find somewhere to park your car, you know, 365 days a year, which means probably paying for it out of the nose.
There's a quick one here from the Brookings Institute, which we all know is funded by the Council on Foreign Relations and also by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. But even they are saying that, why are young people driving less? Evidence points to economics, not preferences. All the stuff about the green aware young people choosing not to drive is bullshit, because as we've talked about, learning to drive, getting insurance and buying a car is unfathomably expensive if you are 18 and you don't come from money. We're talking $25,000 to get driving now.
I don't know about 25. I think you could probably do it for less than 10 if you really knew what you were doing.
I'd say on average it probably costs people 25 grand to get driving, get a car, get insurance for the first year.
No, I still think that's a bit over the odds. I think probably about 10. But that 10 would be, you know, an absolute banger that costs 1,500 quid and you're probably putting it on your parents' name and then you'd be a designated driver on it.
But they talk about the fact that, you know, minimum parking requirements being removed, congestion charging, pedestrian-friendly infrastructure, which we talked about during the demobilisation stuff. Even outside of raw financials, you are disincentivized greatly from driving. You know, how big cities are finding innovative ways to nudge people to ditch cars. That's part
of
this
from 2016 as well.
This is from 2016 as well. This is back when the nudge unit was kind of in vogue. But again, this is something that's being done to young people. It's not something that's happening naturally. Another source here talking about the fact that young people are driving a lot less. I don't want to read this one, but it talks about, you know, a massive decline here. This is 1983 to 2014. The percentage of 16-year-olds driving has basically halved.
And then look at the inverse at the bottom.
Yeah.
That 70 and older, that's up 24%. That's almost kind of interesting that the older people who would otherwise have relinquished an element of mobility in their twilight years have decided not to do so.
Yes. It's a great example of the fact that the inverse of this is the Great Reset has already happened for young people, but old people live in a parallel universe. They live in a parallel Britain that effectively no longer exists. We'll probably do the other half of it at some point, because that's possibly even sadder.
Yes, the boomer paradise.
Millennials dominate the US workforce, but they're still 10 times poorer than boomers.
This is, just before we get into this, it's one of the points that relates to that.
We're moving on here to general wealth. Those were US numbers, by the way. That it's not just a UK phenomenon, that the number of 16-year-olds in America who drive has halved since the 80s. That is American numbers, so I just thought I'd add that.
Yeah, the canteen effect doesn't just work in terms of those who, you know, get the money compared to those who don't have it. If you are born in a situation where some generation of people has already benefited from the canteen effect for the last 20 or 30 years, you know, you are completely screwed. Especially when, essentially, you know, you look at the boomers as having the wealth that has been accrued for centuries.
Yes.
You know, it's not just that the boomers decided that they were going to be really clever and make loads and loads of money for themselves. No, they took decades and decades and decades, if not centuries, of generational wealth and have squandered every single penny of it.
Yes, they were the last generation to not be hit by the modern version of inheritance tax.
Meanwhile, anyone that's been born after the fact has lived in an ever more difficult situation to build up any sort of wealth at all.
Yes. Emojis, post-war USA was unique. Yeah, post-war USA was based on the utter destruction of Europe and then profiting off it. But we've moved on to our generational wealth section here. This really, these are the 1-2 punches of why they own nothing.
Mm.
Because if you are, like I said, millennials dominate the US workforce, but they're still 10 times poorer than boomers. This is really just an insider article from Business Insider talking about the fact that generation holds just 4.6% of the 5.19 trillion of US wealth. And the fact that they are a lot poorer in terms of their net worth than their parents were at the time. This one's a bit of a fluff article, but it's, again, more of us using mainstream sources to illustrate a point in that the millennials are universally acknowledged to be far, far poorer than their boomer parents were. Here's the one they referenced from the Institute of Fiscal Studies, which is Intergenerational Differences in Income and Wealth. The evidence. This has, like, the full set of charts in it, and a lot of them are quite hard to read, but this is a deeper look, and this is more of a research for you guys thing. But this is where these numbers come from. I'm going to skip through this one because it's a bit dry. Millennials are paying more for less, the Times. They go into the fact that really, in terms of it being a taxed base, millennials pay more taxes and yet receive less in state services than any generation since the war, a new analysis forecast. Not only are they 10 times poorer at the age of 30 than the boomers were, they are also being soaked by the state a lot more. So their wealth is going less far. They are being used as a fleece to get tax base to subsidize the boomers who are far richer than them and have had a far higher standard of living throughout their entire lives.
Well, yeah, at best, you maybe are someone who is, you know, late Gen X, early millennial. Your parents, and this is one of the other important points we're going to come back to in a second, your parents have stayed together.
Yes.
They're able to pass on a non-mortgaged house to you. And then, of course, if it costs any more than 400 grand, you get taxed on 40% over that. Which means in a lot of situations, most people will be lucky enough just to inherit some debt.
Yes.
Or the 50-year mortgages that we looked at a wee while back.
It's a well-worn pattern. I'm not going to go into that. I don't think I have to prove to you generationally how badly off like under 30s are compared to previous generations. That is well-worn ground. Again, there's the stuff in the notes for this going to go over yourself.
But it's just that all of these things compound and interact with one another. And I thought that one of the cruxes that I added to the notes when I was looking at them earlier on is the divorce rate. Because if you don't have two parents of your native-born ethnicity handing down both culture, skills, wealth onto you, then you are separated from the practice that basically everybody born before about 1960 knew as the norm.
Divorce,
and this is one of the,
yes,
the biggest aspects of the whole, you know, great reset, re-engineering of Western culture into something completely different, is that you do not have two parents and an extended family who you live nearby, know well, get along with, and can integrate into your own family life and career and mobility.
Yes.
All these things are intersecting. And as soon as you start to break certain elements of it, and I think this being one of the biggest ones, of course, because I think in the 60s and 70s you have the end of like no-fault divorce, or the start of no-fault divorce, and completely reorientating how those sort of laws and situations work socially, and the culture on top of that of, oh, well, now men and women must deal with each other on an equal footing, and this, that, and the next thing. There is, that link is completely broken.
Newsack in the chat, I think you're ignoring the fact that a huge part of the population are only waiting for their parents to die off, and then they'll be rich. I think that's slightly facetious, but we're kind of going into why that won't happen.
Yeah.
A lot of the wealth of the boomers is split between these single-parent households, some of which have step families. The breakdown of the traditional family in terms of divorce rates has been a huge driver of the loss of generational wealth. The boomers have squandered their mid-years, their 40s, and expensive divorces. And they have done so by buying two separate properties and having mortgages in later life.
Yes.
And then also doing equity release in later life. The generational wealth of the boomers no longer exists because they are divorced and going on cruises.
Or the millennials, the Gen X, they should be handing that inheritance on to, have already themselves divorced. From, yes, relationships that were only started maybe 10 or 15 years ago.
It's the knock-on effect across careers, wealth, demographics. Community cohesion's a big one. These are also why these people feel like they're up in nowhere, because they are the product of broken homes. Something I always like to bring out as a illustration of the you'll own nothing and you'll be happy being a reality is the pizza on tick.
Well, yeah, I remember getting a pretty good a tweet about that one ages ago, about the fact that buy now, pay later does the real heavy lifting for you'll own nothing and be happy.
Yes, it does. All of these systems exist, and it's not the fact that you don't own the pizza. It's the fact that you don't have to own the pizza.
You don't own the means to actually access pizza.
Yes.
You're only really able to access pizza through a credit or finance intermediary that you're privileged enough to use.
We'll get into that as well, because the last thing I mention is the fact that UK inheritance tax limit has remained the same at about 350,000, whereas the average house price has ballooned past 400k. This means generational wealth will not be retained, not even in the form of family homes. At best, one can expect to inherit debt and very little else. So the inheritance tax boundaries do greatly affect this.
It's wealth not only being inflated away, but inflated away into a manner which actually is adjusted the wrong way round.
Yes.
You know, there's like a double punishment for it. Not only is it being inflated away, but the amount that's being inflated away over the top is also taken off you.
Well, this is the whole, you know, what was I put in the notes? It's beats run thick. Dino gets his kicks from his beats run thick, which needs to be like a line in like a Chumbawamba song. But well, that's enough tub thumping for one day. There's a lot we're not going over here, but I'd like to get on to really wrapping all this up because we've been a little bit all over the map. But there are a large amount of compounding factors here. And I'm using the background art here. I'm once again using that terrible German bird, Laura Breeling, and her horrible Globo Homo art to push home my points. Because once again, this is not parody. This is the way they see the world. But the further breakdown of traditional communities and towns as urbanization increases is an engine. Without even the demographic factors, this has been happening since the 19th century. Urbanization resulting from having to live near a job due to lack of personal transport leads to further decreased mobility. Again, it is an engine, it is a cycle. This urbanization feeds young people into contact and competition with the immigrant populations that outnumber them in urban areas in many places. It not only feeds people into competition with each other, it feeds them into competition with non-Brits, which is why all of this is so sharp. They are urbanized, they are demobilized, they are demoralized, and they are detached from generational wealth. A need to cluster around job hotspots puts under 25s into homes of multiple occupancy and long-term rentals, which in turn means they are unable to have children, especially young white professionals. Mass immigration of working-age peoples dilutes wages and increases housing competition. Culturally, white British people, and this is the important part, are the most susceptible to these forces, as they have nowhere to retreat to, nowhere to return to, and are less prone to working outside the system, and are less prone to criminality. That is the big point in that if you, as we talked about during our Crime and the Cash Society stream, if you factor in the willingness of immigrant communities to break what are cultural taboos with white British people, they are able to gain large advantage. Benefit cheating, naked criminality, fiddles, fixes, all of this, and their ability to work within a framework of racial preference for their own group means that they have a leg up over culturally white people, over, you know, ethnically white people. It is a huge unspoken factor that they are able to get around many of these control aspects simply by having less respect for the system rather than law.
It's something we've discussed both in the Crime and the Cash Society, and it's heavily predicated on the idea that and some form of recompense for colonialism, Western whites should become the host population and the host culture for migratory movements of brown people who may or may not want to stay in your country, but should be able to take advantage of the resources and the people there as they please when they do.
For more on that, actually see our Tony Soprano The Last Patriarch stream. There's some good stuff about...
I can read the next one if you want.
Oh yeah, you can read that one.
Another probably relevant for me as well here. If you're aged under 25 in the UK, the Great Reset has already happened for you. You own nothing and you're probably at least pretending that you're happy. If you're over 18, you likely live in a single room or with parents. You do not drive. You are urban, rootless, do not have savings, and you have to be subservient and moving around to suit your career and your income. Demographically, people your age are far less likely to be born British and far less likely to even have two parents. Never mind for those parents to actually be ethnically British on top. So it's, again, this compounding set of effects. For those under 18, they are between 31% and 40% non-British. This only gets worse the younger you look, as we saw in the graphs earlier on.
Yeah.
And as children age, immigration stays high, as it seems to be.
Yes.
This will only increase and get worse. The strategy is simple. Create incremental and sometimes rapid change in the shape of UK generations and wait for those from an older worldview to die off. The same will happen with, say, something like the Brexit vote. Many of the over 65s who voted Leave are now dead. Demographically, they can simply wait out democracy as the next generations are transformed largely by immigration and children of mass immigrants. Demographically, those people support certain causes and vote as reliable blocks. You know, why re-engineer a populace when you can engineer its replacement and heighten the dying off process? Now, that's not to say that we only believe that this is something that affects voting. I believe that's very much a secondary aspect
yes.
of it. Because one thing I've always been very, very adamant about, and you will see people do this, they do this to this day. Many an American political commentator, your Tucker Carlson's, whatever, will talk about the Great Reset and the fact that the Democrats are using it to fix voting.
Yeah.
When that's such a long way down the line to the actual effects, you know. What about the ethnic disparities, or the fact that your culture's been eroded, or your people are both being literally and figuratively raped? No, that comes secondary, the fact they're playing around with the voting numbers.
Well, it is secondary, but it's also a very visible example of them celebrating this process. They are able to celebrate this process through the vector of the meaningless democracy.
Mm.
But that is part of the victory lap. And that's the way I wanted to frame this. The strategy is simple. Create incremental and sometimes rapid change in the shape of UK generations and wait for those from an older world to die off. They aren't going to go after all the people who are flag-waving, you know, the British patriots who remember the pre-60s, because they're all going to die soon.
Yeah, they'll just play the long game.
They can simply wait them out, and that is the point. By the time the people who are in their 30s reach their 60s, the reality will be that all that we see demographically and all that we see lifestyle-wise will be their normality.
Mm.
And the victory lap, I believe, will be, you know, when there's inevitably the next Brexit vote.
Do we want to add the last two little bits we've got here on top of this as well, or should we finish off here?
I just want to talk about many of those who over 65 voted
we'll
Leave
and are dead. Demographically,
those people support certain causes and vote as reliable blocks.
Oh, so we've already read this out.
No,
I read it out earlier.
Yeah, but the big part is as well that not just voting blocks, but they are able to act as cultural blocks. There's a couple of bits I'd
yeah.
like to get.
Well, it's the sort of you've mentioned here, like, what are we leaving out? Because the situation is that it's actually worse.
Yes.
You know, 7 in 10 young people are worried about a climate crisis, which, you know, fair enough having like 10% of your population worry about like the woke or culture war dialectics bad enough. Imagine having 30 or 40% of people being a constant sort of psychosis about the environment.
Well, this is going to lead into Wednesday. On Wednesday, we're going to discuss this stuff more specifically about the kind of belief systems and what kind of will be the fate of Generation Z. We talk about viewers, praise, hope-filled Channel 4 school, Channel 4's The School That Tried to End Racism, as pupils as young as 11 are experimenting to change their unconscious preference towards white people.
Grim.
Actually, like Pol Pot back in the field, you will not favour your own people. Gun to your head stuff.
This obviously relates back to the whole skill collapse thing, because
yes.
even the idea of education as socialization has broken down.
Yes.
It doesn't even do this anymore. Youths are born online, and post 2000 really should be studied like some sort of different social animal than how we otherwise normally understand human interaction, because they don't have the family, they don't have the nation, they don't have the community, they don't have proper careers, they don't live in proper homes. No wonder they're a mess.
Yeah. there's a quick one to finish up here from, well, yesterday, I believe, which is Rishi Sunak has set the new target for migration to be less than 500,000.
Mission accomplished.
Which is funny because when the Conservative Party first got into power, the target was 90,000. Mm. Interesting one. But this, we're leaving out, you know, the stuff that can get worse, basically. We're taking a snapshot and extrapolating it forward. But even as the conditions as they stand now, if nothing else changes, the Great Reset has already happened for everyone under the age of 30 and will continue to be their reality as their age. That is the main thesis of this stream. And I hope that we have provided a good enough body of evidence for it. I will once again do a little bit of shilling. Like I said, we are still monetized. If you guys want to become members, that's the best way to support us on a recurring basis. Thank you, Tank Imperator, there for the $11 Canadian. A wonderful example of why voting and ultimately democracy is a scam, because they can just go in and like actually engineer entire generations. Yes, it's kind of low on the totem pole. Fishy Frenzy donated £2, said seems the Conservatives added a zero to their pledge. It seems, yeah, they added a zero, and that's all they've done in 13 years, added a zero. Once again, do leave a like, do leave a comment, do go over to the Substack if you're interested in our solutions to this, as people talked about, because the Substack does have a large back catalogue of content that talks exactly about how we get ourselves out of this situation. Again, thank you for coming to the stream. Thank you to everyone who donated. Thank you to all of our members. Do look out for the pinned comment if you want to go through the sources for this stream. I'll not get too long in the tooth, and I'll say a big thank you to people who are still coming to our informal Nomos event. You will get details, do not worry. We'll see those people Friday, Saturday, and you guys have a good night. If there's nothing need to add.
We'll see you Wednesday. Good night.
Good night.